So if you have a Bible, maybe you have an app on your phone that can give you access to the Bible. You go to the New Testament, the book of Philippians, and I just want to open up by reading to you chapter 2, verse 5. Verse 5, and this is what Paul says in chapter 2, verse 5, in regards to Jesus. In your relationships, obviously, this your relationships is a plural component, is using the S at the end. In your relationships with one another, I want you to have not necessarily a better relationship, not necessarily a relationship that you have never had before, or an improvement of where you are today. He basically tells us, in every relationship, I want you to have one single goal, which is the adoption of the mindset that Jesus Christ had. This is a loaded statement, because for me, when I read this, the first thing that becomes offensive to me, and I don't know if you ever find the Bible offensive, but it's offensive because it's giving the implication, or is assuming, that I don't have the mindset of Jesus Christ. Now, I'm about to walk you through the rest of the process, through the rest of the verses, and I don't think we have it. I don't think we have the mindset of Jesus. So if you don't, or if you are like me and you struggle with the mindset of Jesus, man, this is the perfect day to talk about this. Why? Because when you have the mindset of Jesus on a day like this, when you and I approach the resurrection of Jesus not simply as factual, which I don't have the time to get you into the sources of corroboration of the resurrected Christ outside the Bible. So I'm here to tell you that I don't believe that you need faith to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. I think you can prove the resurrection of Jesus outside of faith. I think faith is going to become very, very helpful to process and the implications of that. I want to talk to you about this concept of relationships in that framework of the resurrection. So since you and I do not have the mindset of Jesus, here's what it implies. It implies that when it comes to relationships, because I've read enough of this brother by the name of Paul, he's the writer to this letter, and I've read enough of the Bible, and I have experienced and I have known Jesus for a while, here's what I will tell you. My tendency is to believe and to think that the most important relationship in my life is my relationship with Christ. But understanding the mindset of Jesus implies that the most important relationship in my life is not my relationship with God or Christ. The most important relationship in my life, this is what it means to have the mindset of Jesus, is the relationship between Jesus as a son and the Father. That relationship between them is what allows me to have a relationship with God. If you move away from that relationship, and again, going back to the resurrection, going back to Good Friday and today, the resurrection of Jesus is the byproduct of a relationship that Jesus had as an expression of his mindset. So the way his worldview, his feelings, his emotions, the way he related to the Father eventually is going to take him to Good Friday, which we know the story, he's going to be crucified, but also that mindset brings him into the resurrection. And you and I become the recipients, get the domino effect of that relationship between the Father and the Son, that today, if you are a child of God, is because of the relationship between the Father and the Son. So I am not against your relationship and my relationship with the Father. I'm obviously not against your personal relationships, but you got to make sure that this morning, embracing the resurrection of Jesus Christ implies that the most important relationship in your life is the resurrection between the Son and the Father. Why? Here's the why. And I hope you agree with me on this one. The reason is because since this is Easter, and many of us come to church on Easter, many of you come every Sunday to church, whatever you are on this regard, if you think that the most important relationship in your life is your relationship with God, the tendency, I'm not saying that you do this on purpose, I'm not saying that you're a bad person, all that I'm saying is that our tendency is to simply approach God as long as he agrees with me. Because I'm so used to define relationships, I'm so used to determine how I relate with people. And to a certain degree, is unavoidable. This is why my relationship with God has to be based not necessarily on how and what I think about God. It has to be based on how the Son, Jesus, related to the Father. And whatever and however they related, that's how I relate. And that's extremely difficult. Why? Because here's where you get into the component of this relationship. So the relationship between the Father and the Son that eventually involves me, because I'm going to say this one more time. If the Son does not obey nor satisfy the Father, if the Father is not okay with the Son, you do not know salvation. Your salvation, your experience of knowing Jesus is the result of a satisfied Father and then a Son that was willing to obey. That implies that in this case, that relationship between the two of them give us as an end result a legal component that has to do with innocence and righteousness. So let me explain what I mean by that, because here is where I move into the legality. The legality of the component is that a couple of months ago, we purchased our fourth vehicle in our home. So we are five in the family, and out of the five, two of my older girls, they drive. My youngest, he doesn't drive yet. So that implies that I have a vehicle, Areli has a vehicle, Sarai has a vehicle, Rebecca has a vehicle. And Rebecca, being the middle child and being the second oldest, she was the fourth to get a vehicle. So we went and purchased a vehicle. When we purchased a vehicle, we did something that many of you have done. We did an exchange. We did a trade-in. So what we literally did on that day, we took an older vehicle, and we took the vehicle with us, and we said, we have this vehicle. Would you, this is what we're looking for. Would you give us, some sort of an estimate? How much would you give us for the vehicle? We were satisfied with the offer, So we literally walked into this place, and we took our older vehicle. We went through the process. We negotiated. We did what we typically do on trade-ins, and eventually we have to give to the dealer our vehicle, and the dealer kept our vehicle. But in return, the dealer gave us a new vehicle. So we drove, we walked, we got out of the place with a brand new vehicle. But the prerequisite for you to get the new vehicle, you have to trade in your old vehicle. So that was on a Thursday, Friday, something like that. The very next day, got a call. Says, hey, we made a mistake on the paperwork. And is there any way you guys can come back? Now, on the vehicle, the two of us, we have the signatures, my wife and I. So I told him, I said, dude, to be honest with you, because he was telling me, can you come back on Monday? And I said, Monday's going to be tough because of work schedule. But I told him, I said, I'm available Sunday if you are. That's what I said. He said, okay, can you come at 10 o'clock in the morning? And I said, I'm not that available. I'm available. That's the only day I work. So I'm a pastor. That's a joke. But I said, hey, but I can meet you around 1:30 or so. So literally on that Sunday, whenever that was, a couple of months ago, after church, we went and met at McDonald's. Right here, by Business 83, and Jackson, and we met at McDonald's, and the guy came, McDonald's, the dealer guy, and he brought the paperwork, brand new paperwork, of the paperwork that we had in the glove compartment of the new vehicle, and we took the old envelope, or the envelope with the documentation. He tore those apart. He showed us the difference or the mistake that was made, and he showed us the new documents, and Ariel and I, we on that table in McDonald's, we make this legal transaction of signing for the new vehicle. The vehicle was with us for 2 days prior to the signing, but there was no legal, there was no official obtaining of the vehicle until that legality took place. So today we have the legal documents. I want you to translate that into your relationship with God. If you are a follower of Jesus, or you decide to follow Jesus today, as much as the intellect is involved, as much as the emotions are needed, as much as a lifestyle is embraced, there is a legal component that is the result of the relationship between the Father and the Son. That legal component is what we call Good Friday. On that Friday, 2 days ago, 2,000 years ago, Jesus died in your place. And his death, what happened with Jesus dying for you, is that he gave you the ability to place your guilt and your sin, not your mistakes, not your oops, not simply your regrets, but your sin. The fact that you and I committed cosmic treason, we place our sin in Jesus. And when we trusted Jesus and he went to a cross and he died, he gave us what is called innocence. So Jesus brought us into the status that Adam had prior to sinning. As you know, and I hope and you realize this by now, is that innocence only gets you out of hell. Innocence, you placing your trust in Jesus, only allows you to avoid hell. To me, when I think about avoiding hell, which I want to avoid hell, please hear, don't hear me say that I want to go to hell. But all that I'm saying is like me marrying my wife 22 years ago and saying at the altar, doing our vows, because now people, you know, write their own vows, which anyways, that's a different conversation. Doing our vows is that concept that I said, okay, Areli, I'm going to stick around with you for the purpose of not divorcing. That's not going to go well. It's not going to be a good day for me or for my wife. Because the purpose of marriage is not to avoid divorce, right? So the purpose of this whole deal of Easter, resurrection, is not so you can avoid hell. It's necessary that you avoid hell. So hopefully you're in this place and your guilt are simply dissipated and clean because of Good Friday. But on a Sunday like this, it is obvious that the exchange of those keys that I just gave you, the trading of the old self, your sin, traded in by or to his righteousness on Sunday, now Jesus is giving you the ability to give you, to impute, to cover you, to simply transform your life in a manner that innocence is not enough. Righteousness is the win. So for me, righteousness, and here's what I know this is kind of a big word, which is a big word. It's hard to spell the word and find it on Google. But what it means, hear me say this. Righteousness, what it means is basically his 33 years on earth. So if you're a follower of Jesus, you were forgiven of your sin at the cross. But on that Sunday morning, his 33 years that he lived on earth, because he was on earth for 33 years, his worldview, his emotions, his thoughts, his speech, his behavior has been given to you. It comes with the package. So is the experience that I trade in my old vehicle and get a new vehicle, that's exactly the legal component of how and what salvation is. The question now comes, because again, we're coming from this understanding that the win is not to have relationships. The win is that every relationship beginning between the Father and the Son that eventually involves me, because now I'm a part and the recipient of that relationship through salvation. Now, as I deal with one another, marriage, singleness, work, school, whatever the case may be, the win apparently is the mindset of Jesus. The mindset of Jesus is based on this exchange. That this is not accidental. From the very beginning, the conversation between the Father and the Son required that not only man, humanity, was going to be restored from what happened in Genesis 3. In Genesis 3, Adam was innocent prior to Genesis 3. Once the serpent shows up, once sin and rebellion, we committed cosmic treason, we lost, what did we lose? Our innocence. And we became, what's the opposite of innocence? Guilt. So through Jesus, the win is not that you are a forgiven person. Look at me for a second. The win is not that you are forgiven. The win is that through the 33 years of the life of Jesus given to you at salvation, now you walk, now you are a person not simply forgiven, now you are a person that has never sinned before. Do you see the difference? This is the righteousness of Jesus. So what does that mean? Glad you asked. That's where I'm going. Verse 6. This righteousness, this 33 years of life, is based on the fact that he, Jesus and Jesus alone, being in the very, what is it? Nature, God. Is Jesus that did not consider equality. So the nature and the equality is with God. He is God himself. The Bible says something to be used to his own advantage. So if you are in this place and you have been, if you have been invested, if you have experienced the legality of this transaction between your sin forgiven and Jesus' righteousness, 33 years given to you, here's what Paul is implying. You have become a person that you will do, that you will not, or you will stop doing things for your own advantage. So now, dream with me for a second. Say, I love to dream. Can you imagine a church where everything that we do is for the advantage of someone else? Because typically, what's our typical mindset? What's in for me? Our mindset, we don't mind the whole God thing, the whole Jesus thing. We don't mind Easter. We don't mind Good Friday. We don't mind religion as long as Jesus and God continue to be my cosmic butler. Because I don't know if you've ever been in that place where you feel deceived by God. That you tried, that you gave, that you sacrificed, and things are not working very well for you. Well, the Bible says that the result of this legal exchange that I just explained in the person of Jesus is that although he was in the nature of God, in equality with God, what he's going to do something that is extremely important. That his detachment, that he not considered things for his own advantage implies an aggressiveness. And I want to use the word violence in a sense of just non-apologetically. Prior to the foundation of the word, he said his heart for one single thing, which is to obey the Father. That's it. And this is why I want you to hear this closely. And I know that the lights are dim, so I hope your eyes are open because I see silhouettes, okay? But here's the point. Our tendency right here, right now, in this moment, is to look at this word and say, oh, so I just need to become more obedient. And although I think we do, but this is not your obedience. This is the obedience of Jesus. So whatever obedience means through the lenses, through the person, through the worldview, through the feelings, through the emotions, through the decision-making of Jesus, related to the words of the Father, which there is no mystery. The words of the Father is the law, is the Bible, right? There is no mystery what this means. That's exactly what we're supposed to do. So I'm going to say this one more time. This is the part that, again, the exchange, the legal exchange that took place on Friday, and then you became the recipient. I became the recipient on Sunday. That legal exchange of giving my sin and then receiving his 33 years of worldview implies that I must become a person. I must continue to grow on a person that is not looking things for his own advantage. So I'm going to say this one more time. Dream with me. Marriages that they're driven by seeking the advantage of the other person. Can you imagine a generation of millennials and their kids, and then my generation, which is Gen X's, an older generation, that our driving force is not our theology or our doctrinal principles. Nothing wrong with theology, nothing wrong with doctrine is needed. But can you imagine the incarnation, the crystallization of theology and doctrine in a generation that we are always looking? And in other words, hear me say this. Can you imagine a generation that we always give others the benefit of the doubt? What's the opposite? It's having this predisposed mindset that he always fails you. She'll never change. He's exactly the same. That's why I'm single, and I'll never do it again. Anybody? Yeah? You see what I'm saying? It's like, I just cannot wait for these guys to move on and just get their own deal, you know, talking as a parent. Whatever the case may be, thinking about this, just living for others to take advantage. So for Jesus, is incarnated in obedience. Now, here's what I'm going to help you to process this very carefully, because before you sign on the dotted line, before you do the trade-in, so you don't get the call that I got and then you can come back the next day to sign other document, before you do that, let me define obedience. Obedience based on Jesus is basically these two components. That before you experience exaltation, before you experience the goodness and the mercy, what if I told you that the road to exaltation and glory is suffering? What if I told you that Friday is the preamble of Sunday? What if I told you that for Jesus, because of his willingness not to consider the equality and the nature with God, but he's willing to not look for his own advantage, is to understand that suffering is not absent. Simply suffering becomes his vocation. That's exactly why he came. So Friday, look at me. Friday was premeditated, was stipulated, was planned and created before the foundations of the world. That implies that evil, that implies the betrayal, Judas, that implies the loneliness, the disciples running, that implies that religious leaders and even the Roman government, all these broken systems, they became the instruments for the purposes of God. So I am not here to give you a simplistic answer why you are suffering. I do not understand why people suffer. I do not understand the depth of evil. I don't. But all that I know is that when your driving force is to seek the advantages of someone else's, that is reflected on the obedience of Jesus in your life, suffering becomes your vocation. Because suffering becomes the instrument that is growing in you, not necessarily a better version of you by becoming obedient or holier or simply a better person, that the suffering becomes the instrument that the character, the obedience of Jesus is growing in you. And obviously, that ends with the exaltation. So, Friday, Sunday. Now, again, I just have to be honest with you. I have a few minutes. I got to finish this. But some of us, we would love to hear this word applied to you. And eventually, your marriage is going to come back, and you're going to remarry him or her. Or you're hoping that eventually you'll get the job and whatever. Hear me say this. The exaltation is not necessarily of Jesus, although it's Jesus. But the exaltation is of the Father. So the suffering of Jesus serves the purposes of the Father. The resurrection of Jesus coming out of the grave 2,000 years ago is magnifying, not necessarily the Son, but is the Father. Now, watch me say this. The Son gets magnified when the Father gets magnified. So if you're thinking about your economy, your feelings, your emotions, your relationships, your parenting, whatever the case may be, it's a simple deal. If your life exalts the Father, you get exalted. Does that make sense? Now, I'm going to say this again, because this is no prosperity gospel church. You've been exalted. What's the preamble? In other words, Friday is unavoidable, guys. Friday is unavoidable. So what do we do? Here's what we do, quickly. But rather, he made himself. So this component of obedience, you know, suffering, exaltation, implies that he made himself. Come on, say it. He made himself what? He made himself. Understanding that when Jesus came to this world and he lived here in this world for 33 years, when he gave us not simply Adam again or the second Adam, although he's the second Adam, I believe that he's Adam plus. Jesus for 33 years is exactly what man was supposed to be. He's 200% man. So that implies that he became nothing, and he became nothing. And again, this is a mystery. I have no enough time to really dissect this, but what it implies is that to his divinity, because we just read nature and imagery, likeness, God, he added humanity to his divinity. He never compromised his divinity, and this is the reason why Jesus has to be born out of a virgin, because the difference between Jesus, humanly speaking, and everyone else is that Jesus had no sin nature. What does that mean? That implies that even if he wanted to sin, Jesus couldn't sin. It's like God. Have you ever wondered who created God? Yeah, good luck with that one. If you have a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, you got to get those questions. I know you will. But here's the bottom line. Nobody created God, because then he will stop being God. Tracking what I'm saying? So this is the same component that Jesus added to his humanity. So when the Bible says that he literally made himself nothing, is that Jesus chooses, watch this. And I was supposed to say this in the previous two services. I didn't say it, so you get the version of the sermon. What it means, this is what it means, the adding humanity to his divinity. I don't know if you agree with me on this one, but well, I got the mic, so I don't know if you, it doesn't matter. I'm going to say this. The reality is this. If you think about it, the lordship, the sovereignty of God implies that even if you are not a Christian, but if you're a Christian especially, but regardless, is that God has the ability to refrain, to hold back your and my depravity, our sinfulness. In other words, we as humans make horrible things, but we have the ability to do even deeper damage. Anybody tracking what I'm saying? All that I'm trying to tell you is that as God will hold back our depravity, our craziness and brokenness, and although we could do even crazier and deeper sinful, you know, detrimental things, God in his mercy holds us back from those things through, you know, self-reflection, if you're not a Christian, so through meditation or whatever that may be. I believe the same implication is with Jesus. Jesus is going to literally limit himself, that to his divinity, he's going to, not to subtract, he's going to add. And this addition, look what happens. He makes himself nothing by taking the very nature of, and the word is servant, but in reality, he's taking the nature of God. What he did by limiting himself, he literally came and showed us the character of God. So as you sit in this place, you have no right. You have lost your ability to say, well, I don't believe in God because I have never seen God. I don't believe in God because, you know, whatever other rationales you may have, the reality is that Jesus came and served. He gave us, he portrayed, again, the legal exchange, the whole component of everything that I just gave you is to show us how and what a servant looks like. Today, I'm here to tell you that this servanthood is simply the strength that Jesus found in his humility. That as he humbled himself, that's exactly what he gave you. So would you just listen for a second? We're about to pray. Hear me say this. If you are in a place right now that you feel vulnerable, and you feel in a place where maybe this whole transition in life, parenting, elderly years, whatever the case may be, is putting you in a place where you feel that you're losing versus gaining, that you feel more insecure about the future like never before. Or maybe you're at a place where you have grown into this sense of apathy and discouragement that you just don't care what comes next. I don't know where you are. Look at the example of Jesus. The way that he humbled himself is what he found strength. So at this legal exchange of your sin given to Jesus and his 33 years of life given to you is not so you can simply become the top of the line. That you become immune. You remember the teachings of Jesus when he speaks of two men. This is Gospels. And he says the one man, wise man, built the house on the rock. And then the foolish man built the house on the... You know what the moral of the story is? It's not about wisdom and foolishness, although it's important. So build the house on the rock. But here's the thing, that both houses got hit by the storm. So building your house on the rock is not that you avoid either choosing to be humble or being humbled by others. Putting your life and trusting your life in the one who became a servant, his servanthood is not something that you just simply write songs about or that you pray about or that you romanticize about. His servanthood is something that is being given to you. That if you're in this place and you want to find, what I mean, think about it, that you want to find, let me the next slide, guys. If you want to find the presence of God in the middle of whatever is happening, the promise is not that you're not going to find his struggles. The promise was that you will find, and I'm going to say this again, the strength of God has been given to you. What's the venue? Humility. Humility in a manner that he says, this humility, this strength is given to you in the context that this Jesus, who became nothing and who gave you the nature of God through servanthood, yet he made himself in human likeness. And folks, this is the most important statement that you'll hear from me throughout this beautiful morning of a Resurrection Sunday. Because understanding that he was made in human likeness is what I just told you a little while ago. That although he is one person, and because he added humanity to his divinity, he added the human component to the fact that he is in nature, he is in essence, he is God himself, he is the one with two natures. Is one person, two natures. It is a mystery, but this is all that I want to tell you. If the resurrected Jesus is someone that was a man just like me, the beauty of his humanity is that he never lost his divinity. The beauty of his humanity is that he, when he came and he walked among us, he was not simply a rabbi, a man teaching about God. He was God teaching to us. That when I put my trust in Jesus, it's not simply so I can avoid hell and be forgiven of my sin, which is needed. But now the beauty of Jesus, because it's about the relationship between the Father and the Son, and that God not simply gave me a prophet or a priest. He just didn't give me a shepherd, or he didn't give me just another, you know, officer in his whole entourage or his whole system of sacrificial system. He gave me a family member. Because God is not simply doing the things that he does so he can get a better version of myself. He is the God that he has two essence, that he is the God-man. He is the divine essence walking among us, and his entire essence has been given to you. That you're in a place right now where you can openly confess that when he was found in appearance as a man, as he is the one too, the one Christ with two essence, as he walks, he humbled himself. my goodness. The Bible doesn't say that he was humbled, but that he voluntarily humbled himself. By what? Simply by becoming, come on. Is that a clear statement today? It's about obedience. The obedience that eventually put him to the experience of what? His obedience was the vehicle, was the path, was the result of simply understanding that God in his sovereignty, God in his dominion, God in his godness, he knows best. Do I fully understand? No, I don't. Is my tendency like Judas to betray him because he's an imposter? Is my tendency like Peter and the other disciples that are going to flee away from that Friday experience? You better believe it. That's you and I. We are broken. We are driven by our senses. We are fragile. We look at this word humility and we look at that negatively. But look at what happens. The obedience of Jesus is going to take him into the experience of deadness. So it's pretty obvious that if you want to experience life everlasting with Jesus on a Sunday like this, you're going to have to die. You have to give up your old vehicle and trade in for a brand new vehicle. Tracking with me? This is the experience where you say no to self and you say yes to Jesus. Now, before I pray, so I gotta give you the whole thing. And I've been tamed before I pray. This time I'm going to pray. But before I do that, I just cannot let you guys go without seeing the end. Do you see the last word on this sentence? What kind of death did he experience? In other words, I'm a Jew guy, Paul writing, Jew. He's writing primarily to Jewish people, a couple of Gentiles. But in Jewish culture, they wouldn't mind obedience to death as long as it's not the death of... See, in the Jewish culture, death, especially if you are disobedient to the law, if you are a trespasser, if you are someone who is a lawbreaker, the death that the Jewish culture gave is, what is it? Stoning. It is the Romans who do the cross. So if I'm a Jew, up to this, I'll follow this dude called Paul and Jesus on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I'll follow them. But the moment Paul says that he was going to die on a cross, as a Jew, that is a stumbling block. As a Jew, that is mockery. As a Jew, you are offending me. Because you got to remember that I don't mind the death component as long as you don't tell me, because I was a witness. I was there when Jesus walked on water. I was there when he healed the lame and he gave sight to the blind. I was there when he spoke and people came to him. And then I was there, watch this, I was there when Jesus not only healed people, but he forgave people of their sins. And according to my tradition and my understanding of this whole component, only one person can forgive sins. His name is God. So are you telling me, Brother Paul, that the God who came and taught us, because we just said that, he wasn't just a rabbi who taught about God, but God dwell among us, he has been cursed? Because Deuteronomy says that cursed is the man who hangs on a tree. And the answer is yes. Because at the cross, there was a merger. There was something that came together and blended. At the cross, the God who demanded justice provided the justifier. The God who poured his wrath on Jesus through his suffering and his deadness, he gave you and gave us everlasting joy and love in Jesus Christ. As you sit in this place, and if you were willing today to make the exchange, the legal exchange of your sin, for the 33 years of Jesus' worldview, righteousness, you're making a commitment to live life the rest of your days on a merger. Why? Because you will become just, but you will continue to be a sinner. Salvation is the beauty of the holiness and the righteousness of God imputed in you, and yet we still sinners. How do you resolve that tension? You don't. You lived on that tension. And that's exactly where we are today. That's it. That makes sense when you find yourself in this unresolved tension that you want to obey, but you struggle to obey. You want to believe, and then your experiences tell you that there is no God. And you're in this dichotomy, and this is why I began the conversation today telling you that this begins with a legal component. It's not how you feel. It's not even how you perceive or how you embrace this merger. It's a legal component that if you are willing to put your trust in Jesus, and you will to confess your sins, Jesus will not only forgive you, but he will give you himself to you. So when the situation comes of love and justice coming together, you're going to have the ability to trust in the trustworthiness of Jesus. That no matter what happens, you believe that the resurrection of Jesus gives meaning to the death of Jesus. Because if Jesus did not obey and live a life of holiness, the cross is simply pointless. There is just sacrificial nonsense, but the justice poured into Jesus is because his love for the Father for 33 years have been given to you. And today, you can experience that love by putting your trust in Jesus. Would you pray?